Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Klofsky coming at you live from Gulfman Synagogue. I'm not in my house today. Gulfman Synagogue, usually I'm here in the shul. And we're going to continue our study of 1 Kings, continuing chapter 9. And I think we might actually complete chapter 9 tonight. Hopefully that'll be the case. I'm looking forward to it. I'm all by myself at the moment, though we're expecting some other people to be joining us. Maybe the usual suspects, maybe one other person. When they show up, that would be great. But we're going to just blast off because we do not penalize the punctual. And you guys are punctual. If you're calling in, you want to learn Torah right here, right now, and I'm with you. So if you have your Tanakh with you, that's great. Take a look at 1 Kings, Melachim Aleph, chapter 9, and we're going to get started. And like I said, might just finish this up. Let's go take a look. And the next time we meet, we might just be looking at the Queen of Sheba, the famous Malkut Shva. Very exciting stuff. So let's take a look. We ended off last week. We completed verse 21. And let's just do a very, very quick review. You know that Shlomo has been building cities. He built his own palace. He built a Beis HaMikdash. And now he's putting local people to work. Verse 20, we'll just read that in English for review's sake. All the remaining people of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, again, 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 20, the Hivites, the Jebusites, who were not of the children of Israel, verse 21, even their children who remained after them in the land, whom the children of Israel were unable to annihilate, of them, of these tribes, did Shlomo raise a levy of forced labor until this day. Forced labor, he forced them to work. It wasn't a monetary thing. It was rather physical labor. Verse 22, this is new, fresh material. Umibnei Yisrael, and from the children of Israel, lo nasan Shlomo Ovid. Shlomo did not make any tax or levy of forced labor. Kihim anshei melchama, because they were the warriors. The Jewish people were serving in the army. Listen to that. Jewish people serving in the army back then. Wow. Tell that to some of my dear friends. They were the warriors. Kihim anshei hamilchama. They were the soldiers. Va'avadav and his servants, whatever that means. We'll get to it. The sarav, his officers. The shalishav and his commanders. The sarei rechbo ufarashav. And also the officers of his chariots. Sarei rechbo, officers of his chariots. Ufar Rashav and his horsemen, and those who rode upon those horses. So Shlomo did not force the Jewish people to do this forced labor. He rather made the local Canaanite tribes do the forced labor. The Jewish people were already serving Klal Yisrael and the king by being the soldiers, his advisors, officers, commanders, and so on. So they already were fulfilling a function. Here we go. Let's take a look and see if there's any footnote worthy of our attention. There is. Verse 22, which we just read, let's take a look at the footnote here in the Judaica Press. But of the children of Israel, Shlomo did not make any levy of forced labor. Didn't put a tax upon the Jews. And they write, the editors write, even though the construction of the temple and the various cities was for their benefit, for the Bnei Yisrael, of course it was for their benefit. Still in all, Shlomo nevertheless exempted them from this tax, from this levy. Why? Mipnei, or rather, kihem anshei melchama, because they were the men of war. They were warriors. That is to say, and here he quotes the Abarbanel, because they served as his military reserves. Because although there were no wars in his time, he kept a standing army as a precaution. So says the Abarbanel. They were the men of war. He had warriors. He had an army. He had a standing army. Why? According to the Abarbanel, it wasn't because he was fighting wars. He wasn't fighting any wars. Rather, it was because this is what a normal person does. you keep a standing army as a precaution and as a warning to your enemies, if you have any. For the most part, my understanding is Shlomo was living in rather peaceful times. He had married the daughters of several of the kings surrounding the land of Israel. And so there was peace between, the Jewish people living in Israel and its neighbors. For the most part, and according to Barbanel, it wasn't for the most part, it was 100% part. There just simply were no wars at that time, according to Barbanel. But still in all, a normal person maintains a standing army as a precaution, because that's what a normal person does. Even if, indeed, according to Barbanel, there are no wars in his time. Still in all, you keep an army going. But the Abarbanel is not the only voice out there. According to this footnote in verse 22, the Radak explains that although there were no major wars, there were, however, minor skirmishes when Shlomo conquered Etzion Gever and Eilat and Hamat Tzova. And for that, you've got to see the footnotes below on verse 26. Verse 26, let me just see what it says over there. Let me just see that quickly. Hold on. Verse 26. There's going to be a mention of Etzion Geber and Eilot on the shore of the Red Sea, Beretz Edom. So according to the Radak, there may not have been major wars fought by the Jewish army, but still there were minor skirmishes going on when he conquered certain areas, and therefore that explains why he maintained an army, because he needed an army in order to conquer these particular locales. Minor skirmishes, even though that's true, notwithstanding the fact that they were minor, you still usually don't win battles if you have zero army guys doing it. You have to at least put somebody down on the ground, boots on the ground, to be able to do it, b'derech hateva, and that's usually how many, many wars are won. Except the time the Eberstein, wipes out the Assyrians overnight, wipes out the Egyptians. Obviously, those are miracles, but can you count on them? No, not until God says, I'm going to do a big miracle. Till then, if you have a minor skirmish, you got to send men in. So that's how it was done. So again, according to the Abarbanel, there were no wars in his time. According to the Radak, there were some small ones. And that would explain why he had an army. For the Radak, you have to have an army. You're having a minor skirmish. For the Abarbanel, it's just a precaution. His servants, what's shot in the word his servants? What does that mean? In the Pasuk Chaf Beis, you've got Anshei HaMelchama, those are the warriors, and then you've got Avadav, his servants. So what's shot his servants? Who are those people? That is, I.E. stands for id est in Latin, id, that, est is, that is, that's how we say it in Latin, his servants, that is, welcome, they were the king's servants. Welcome to all. We're in 1 Kings chapter 9, and we're looking at verse 22. Shlomo HaMelech, Solomon, has impressed into the service of building his temple and his other main buildings and other places throughout the land of Israel. He puts the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites into the service. But Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, he did not put them, he did not impress them into the army. Instead, they were already serving, according to the rabbis, they were already serving as his soldiers. And as it says in verse 22, chapter 9, verse 22, children of Israel were already serving Solomon as his warriors, servants, officers, commanders, and officers of his chariots and his horsemen. So you already have Jewish people serving the king in that particular capacity. So if you already have Jews serving, there's no reason in the world to impress tens of thousands of Jews further and make them work. You already have Jews working for you. So Solomon took the local Canaanite tribes and forced them into the service. Now, how come they were not annihilated? How come when the Jewish people entered the land of Israel under Joshua's time and beyond, how come we're still living in Solomon's time with Hivites, Jebusites, Ahittites, Amorites, Perizzites? What's going on? Why are they still alive? Remember, they've been given some choice. When the Jewish people came in, they gave the local Canaanite tribes three choices. Who remembers what those choices were? The choices were, you either abide by the seven mitzvahs of Noah, or B, you, again, I think they offered total conversion, or C, you leave comfortably, or D, you get ready for war. There were three choices. Either keep the seven mitzvahs, or leave peacefully, or if you stick around and you don't want to keep the seven mitzvahs of Noah, that's your prerogative, but we're going to fight you. So those are the three choices. So according to the footnotes, take a look. If you've got the Judaica Press, then you can see the footnote on verse 21, which we read last week. And I'll read it to you again, where it says, regarding the Canaanite tribes, their children who remained after them. They were not of the children of Israel. They never converted to Judaism. And you've got these Canaanite tribes. Says the Kliyoker, I'm reading it here from the footnote from the Judaica Press, since the original inhabitants of the land had been inadvertently permitted to remain there, contrary to the precept of the Torah, which is all Canaanite nations that remained in the land and did not convert were to be destroyed. Because of this sin, the children of the nations of Canaan became so strong that the Israelites were unable to destroy them. They were only able to subjugate them. And that's exactly what we see over here. Solomon is subjugating these Canaanites. There was no way to, you know, annihilate them at this point. There's so many of them. But rather, there were tens and tens of thousands. Solomon, who is now at the pinnacle of his power, was able to put the pressure on them and force them to serve as, we're going to see, they're going to be hewing out stone, and they're going to be overseers, and they're going to be lifting the stuff and carrying it, and tens of thousands of men are going to be doing this. And these are the men doing it, these local Canaanite guys. But not the Jews, not local B'nai Yisrael, because they were already serving Solomon, as we see in verse 22. They were already serving in very meaningful positions, and therefore they were not impressed into the service to do this exceptionally heavy lifting, which was going to be necessary to build all the stuff that Solomon needed. So again, verse 22, in review, in the English, but of the children of Israel, Shlomo made no levy of forced labor, because they were the warriors, his servants, his officers, his commanders, and the officers of his chariots and his horsemen. And now we're going to see what each one of these things are. What does it mean, his servants? What do you mean, officers? What do you mean, commanders? Why are you laying that out? Is one different from the next? Answer, yes. According to our footnotes here, we've got his servants, Avadav. What does that mean? They were the king's servants performing all necessary labor. Where? In the palace. They were not out in the street. They weren't out at the mountain hewing out the heavy stone and then lifting it and carrying it and whatever, sliding it. I mean, that's real heavy stuff. That's what the Canaanites did. But the B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish guys, they were working in the palace. They were not conscripted to perform the strenuous tasks involved in construction work. Because that was beneath them. The Jews wanted to have palace. They wanted to have high-level jobs in the palace. That's what Jews want. Everybody else, you do the construction. Does that sound familiar? Does that not sound like modern-day Israel? I mean, come on. Who's doing construction in Israel today? Arabs. Am I crazy? I'm not judging anything. I'm just letting you know that this is where the jobs are. And the Jews, they prefer to serve in the Ministry of Defense or whatever. And the Arabs are looking for work. They're going to be doing a lot of very heavy lifting. That seems to be how it plays out. Not exclusively. I'm not saying that every Arab is doing that. There are doctors and lawyers among them, no doubt. But a lot of the guys are doing some pretty heavy lifting in Israel today. And it just sounds like the more things change, the more they might stay the same.
I was just thinking, the irony is that in the early period of Chalutziyut, of political Zionism, of, you know, the pioneers rebuilding, that model was very strongly rejected by leaders of the movement. Kibbutz was the ideal, and those that didn't go kibbutz, but it was still to do the work of your hands, right? It was a very, very big principle of many of the earlier pre-state and post-state Israeli leadership. And gradually, when things settled down in the 50s or more than the 60s and so on, then it seemed to be reverted towards that norm. I don't know, it was just sometimes it seems to be radicalized that gradually there's a regression to the norm, or is it something innate, you know, in Jewish society or what? But you know, I find it interesting that the very, very big, you saw the very big fundamental principle of the Zionist movement has long become dormant, let's say.
Interesting. Thank you for that. Yep. Back in the day, it was indeed a great, great chashuv thing to drain the swamp and build the roads and build the buildings. This is Jewish handiwork. And that was the great pride of the Zionist movement. Decades later, things changed. Amazing stuff. Thank you, Rabbi Berlin, for that. We continue on. That idea that I said earlier about how the B'nai Yisrael were serving as the king's labor in the palace, that was the Abarbanel, the Spanish scholar of the 1400s. We continue on. What does it now mean when it says Sarav in verse 22? What's that mean? Sarav, his officers. Who are the officers? Who were Solomon's officers? They were the king's advisors, says the Abarbanel. They were the king's advisors. And how about his commanders? And that's Shalishav. What does that term mean, the commanders? Says our footnote, these were military heroes appointed over 1,000 soldiers each, or over 100 soldiers each. Alternatively, these were high-ranking officers, each one appointed over one-third of the army. Hence the word shalishav. Doesn't that scream at you? Shalosh, three, achat shtayim shalosh, one, two, three. So over here, these are shalishav. That suggests the word three. What do you mean three? What's three all about? Each one, apparently there were three of these men, each one appointed over one-third of the army. There you got the word shalishav from the word, from the root shalosh, three. Quoting the Rabbeinu Bachaya in Exodus chapter 14, verse 7. And so that's what the word shalishav means here in 1 Kings. It means high, high-ranking officers, three of them, each one in charge of one-third of the army, and that's why each one was a shalish. He was a third guy, one-third guy. That's how we understand it. And then finally, is it relevant?
Yeah, I was going to say, in the height of World War II, they recreated the rank of a five-star general. How many did they play? I think three. It was Eisenhower, MacArthur, it was Patton, somebody else. So basically, I think three at one time that came out, and the three of them really ran the army. So, you know.
Coming out of here. Look at that. Thank you, Rabbi Berlin. I know I can count on you for that, for these tantalizingly and incredibly interesting little tidbits. I did not know about three guys in the American Army who were five-star generals. That is, I just didn't know. That's great. Thank you so much for that. Shkoyach. And we continue. What's the number? That's going to be the next pasuk. Okay, so now we're introduced to the servants, officers, commanders, and the chariot guys and the horsemen. And that concludes verse 22. We're trying our best, if we can, to finish the chapter tonight. It doesn't mean we're going to daven it up, but it does mean that we're going to try our best to push through there's going to be a little bit of mathematics coming up very soon, and it might even come up now. Here we go, verse 23. In the Hebrew, Eile Sarei Hanitzavim, Asher Al Hamalacha L'Shlomo. These were the commanders over the officers who were appointed, Asher Al Hamalacha L'Shlomo, who were appointed over Shlomo's work. How many of these guys were they? Chamishim v'chamesh me'ot. 550. Chamishim is 50. Chamesh me'ot, 500. Add it all up. 550. Harodim ba'am ha'osim ba'malacha. These are the ones who ruled over the people who engaged in the work. According to 1 Kings chapter 9, our verse 23, we're told that there were 550 supervisors, commanders over the men, 550. Now bank that number, because all I could say is strap on, get ready, because we have a lot of, we got a lot to look at over here, and we will. I got a handout, got 1 Kings, got 2 Chronicles. Let's take a look. Here's a handout for you, and a handout for you. I'm glad. Welcome, Louise. I'm glad you came with your own Sefer Tanakh. That's great. You're looking at 2 Chronicles chapter 2. Now, stay with me just 1 second more. Let's not go to 2 Chronicles just yet. Not just yet. Just in a moment. Okay? Okay. I want you to please, if you can, just for a second, let's see how we're going to do this. I've been thinking about this. How are we going to lay this out? We're going to lay it out as best as we can this way. If you have 1 Kings with you, if you've got 1 Kings in your book as well, maybe you don't. Of course you do. We're in 1 Kings. I'm already in 2 Kings. No. Go back, please, to chapter 5. Please go back for just a moment to chapter 5. Let's see how we're going to be able to kind of duke this out, if we can. I think that we can. Chapter 5 of 1 Kings, it sends you back about 4 chapters, and take a look at verse 29. Okay? Chapter 5, verse 29. If we all have it, that's great. Chapter 5, verse 29. Let me read it to you in English. Keep it all in English for now, for clarity's sake. Chapter 5 of 1 Kings, verse 29. So Shlomo had 70,000 who bore burdens, nosei sabol. They were the carrying types. They carried stuff. They carried the burdens. And 80,000, chotzei bahar. They were hewers in the mountains. Those are the guys, they were coal miners. I mean, they were cutting out rock, cutting out stone, cutting out whatever it was in the mountains. 80,000 were working hard in the mountains, cutting stuff out of the mountains, and then 70,000 were carrying it from the mountains into the construction zone, I presume, right in Yerushalayim, and they were going to be able to then construct the temple and the palace and the whole deal. They brought it into Yerushalayim for convenience sake, obviously. So you have 70,000 who were carrying the burden, 80,000 were cutting it out of the mountains. Now the next pasuk is the one I'd like you to please focus in on. Verse 30 in the English. Besides Shlomo's chief officers that were over the work, and the number is 3,300, who bore rule over the people that brought in the work. Okay, that's pretty King James-ish. There were 3,300 men who were the chief officers, who were the Harodim Ba'am or Sim Ba'Malacha. These are the supervisors of the guys doing the heavy lifting. According to chapter 5, verse 30, how many chief officers were there? 3,300. That's what it says here in chapter 5, verse 30. Okay? Bank that idea. Now, just one more second, and then we're going to take a question. Please take a look now at your handout that I gave you. Now it's relevant. Please take a look at the handout. It says 2 Chronicles. This is out of the Sansino. 2 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 1. I'll read it in English. And Solomon counted out 70,000 men. A score is 20. 3 times 20, 60. And 10, 70. 70,000 men to bear burdens. These are the carrying types. And 80,000, that's 80,000 men who were ewers in the mountains. That's guys cutting stuff out. And that exactly corresponds to chapter 5 in 1 Kings. And 3,600 to oversee them. Ding, 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 ding. Where's that? What? What? What are you talking about? Didn't you just tell me in 1 Kings chapter 5 that there were 3,300 men who were the officers? And now in 2 Chronicles, you're telling me 3,600 men. How come you're not accounting for the other 300 that are accounted for in Chronicles? How come Kings is not mentioning the full number of 3,600? What's up with that? Where'd that go? Where'd the 300 guys go? All right. So bank that thought. All right.
Where did they come from? I would ask you that. Okay. A lot of them is written first.
Okay. Let's keep going. Hold that thought. Let's go back now to verse 23. In our chapter of Kings, which is chapter 9, we're back in.
Wait a minute.
Verse 23. You have a question, Isabel? Go ahead.
Back in chapter 5.
Yeah, chapter 5.
Yes.
Verse 30?
Yeah, back where we were.
Okay. Don't be looking at the footnotes yet. Footnotes give a lot of explanation. We're not ready yet. We have to lay out the problem. We have to just lay out the problem textually to be able to appreciate a footnote. I'm just trying my best to lay it out in an orderly way. Then we'll be able to hopefully appreciate Rashi and his attempt to make some sense out of this. But we can't go to that footnote just yet. Let's just lay out one more verse, and then I think it'll be ripe for the footnote. Would you agree with me on that?
Okay. My other point that I was going to bring up is in chapter 9, are we still talking about the same group of people, or is this after these things were built and we now have different jobs so we can have different numbers of people?
A footnote in Sansino suggesting just that maybe this is a later assignment, a later project, therefore accounting for 3,600 men as opposed to 3,300. Okay. I thought that I saw that in the Sansino footnote. May not have. Okay. Good question. Let's see if we can. I apologize, it gets a little bit technical. You know, we've got this seeming contradiction. The seeming dispute is the right way, I think, to put it. There's a dispute between the account in Kings and the account in Chronicles, and seemingly over the very same thing, you got 70,000 doing this, 80,000 doing that, but the numbers of supervisors, well, that number is not in agreement. So how do you make sense out of that? Let's hold off for just a second and read verse 23. Eila sari hanitzavim, asher al-asher al-hamalach al-islamo, we read already, chamishim v'chameshmeot, again, these were the commanders over officers who were appointed over the work of Solomon. How many? 550, who ruled over the people who engaged in the work. So you've got seemingly 3,300 in one account, 3,600 in another account, and 550 in yet a third account. Well, what is going on? Why is it that we've got three different numbers for the numbers of men who are supervising? 3,600, 3,300. All right, that's pretty close. We're off by 300. All right. But what's with the 550? Where's that number coming from? And what relationship does 550 have with 3,000 plus? What's going on? Now I think that maybe that footnote in chapter 5, which I'll read, maybe now it's ripe for our for the elucidation of these verses. Let's take a look. We'll do it slowly. Won't daven it up. We have a little bit of time. And let's see if this can make some sense. Here we go. I'm hoping it does. I'm going to read this slowly. I am reading the footnote that you'll find in the Judaica Press in chapter 5, verse 30, and where it says, there were chief officers, Sarei Hanitzavim, Solomon's chief officers, over the work, 3,300. So it says in 1 Kings chapter 5, says the Judaica Press, these were the oppressors and the overseers over those who did the work, quoting Rashi. But we're not done by any means. We still have to make some sense out of the numbers. We continue. 3,300. That's the number you're confronted by in 1 Kings chapter 5. Says Rashi, and in Chronicles 2, which I just gave you, chapter 2, verse 1, it says 3,600. An additional 300 men. What was their function? What did those 300 guys do? The extra 300. It is therefore my opinion, quoting Rashi, that the 3,300 men, which you see here in chapter 5, were in charge of 150,000 men. Where's that number from? Well, easy. 70,000 plus 80,000 equals 150,000. So, according to Rashi, so far, 3,300 guys were supervising 150,000 Canaanites as they were hewing out the rock and carrying it to Jerusalem. You need middle management. You need those guys. You need 3,000 plus guys to do it. So that's 3,300. So according to Rashi, this number in front of us in 1 Kings, 3,300, is an accurate number. Stay with me. He has to still account for 300 guys. He's got to be able to sensibly account for the number that comes up here in 2 Chronicles, 3,600. What's Rashi going to do? How's he going to come up with an explanation for 2 Chronicles, 3,600? What's he going to do? Let's see. Well, if you have 3,300 supervisors, as according to 1 Kings chapter 5, in charge of 150,000 schleppers, each one was in charge of 45 and some odd men. Do the math. Each guy was in charge of 45 men. And the 300 men who, oh, watch this. This is an attempt on Rashi's part to make some sense out of 2 Chronicles account, 3,600. And the 300 men who were added in 2 Chronicles were in charge of all of them. 300 men whose number comes up in 2 Chronicles, they were in charge of all of them. So that each of these 300 men was in charge of 500 plus men. Okay? So these 300 men, who were not accounted for in 1 Kings, but are accounted for in 2 Chronicles, will be in charge of everybody, 150,000 schleppers and 3,300 supervisors, with 300 super, super, duper, duper, duper supervisors over that whole number of 153,000 plus. And you shall know the evidence in support of my opinion that there are two other passages on this subject, and they contradict one another, says Rashi. For it says on this topic, in this book of Kings, and we just read it a moment ago, these were the chief officers over Shlomo's work. Remember the number we gave? 550. Well, we just read that number. You can't deny that. In verse 23, we just read it a second ago. There were 550 officers over the work. And in the book of Chronicles, chapter 2, Second Chronicles, chapter 8, I apologize for not photocopying that, but trust me, well, you know what? I have it in front of me, so I'll show it to you. Second Chronicles, chapter 8, verse 10, I'll read it, and you'll see. I'll pass it around. And these were the chief officers of King Shlomo, 250, who bore rule over the people. So according to, look at this, according to 1 Kings, our verse 23, there were 550 officers over the work, but according to 2 Chronicles chapter 8, there are only 250 men in charge of the work. Now make up your mind. Is it 550 or is it 250? Anybody wants to see 2 Chronicles chapter 8? I know you're all skeptical, so of course you want to see it. 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 10. I know, we're going to get there. We're going to get there, hopefully. If I don't lose my mind, I was never good at math. But the Bible is forcing me to get good at math. Here we go.
I'm still confused how you got to this number.
Mrs. Burloff, he hasn't really truly gotten anywhere just yet, I think. No. All he's doing is laying out contradictions.
Okay.
He's going to now make an accounting in a second.
Well, 300 super duper people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get his math.
Okay, stay with me. Maybe it'll be accounted for in a moment. Let's just be patient. I can say that because I read ahead. I read the footnote. So I'm thinking everything's going to be a little bit clearer as we go. But if you really want to see 2 Chronicles chapter 8, be my guest. It's right here, and it says in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 10, 250 men. Chamishim u'matayim. 250 Harodim Ba'am, who were ruling over the people. So which is it, O Bible? 550 or 250? What's the real number? Will the real number please stand up?
250 plus the 300 missing people.
Exactly. See, now you
got
to be patient.
Do,
you got to be patient. I think you were.
So my problem is 3,300 people.
Let's see what
divided
he
by 300 is 11. And 11 and 45 is doesn't come anywhere near 250 in my math.
Here's the beauty of all this. At a certain point, I'm not responsible. You know what I love? I love being able to say those words. I didn't write this, and I'm not Rashi and all that. I'm just trying to lay out what I can, laying out the contradictions and the disputes between the verses, and then we'll see Rashi's approach, and we'll keep moving. Because how do you become a lawyer? You take the law, you know, you take the bar exam. And there's a part of the bar exam called the multi-state. Ask any lawyer how to suffer through that. 200 questions, 200 questions of six topics, and you got to try to get 120 right out of 200. You'll be in the ballpark to pass. So my guy, he said, do your best, answer the questions, hit move, lawyer. Hopefully you pass. Hopefully, you know, you get 120 and you move on. So over here, we're going to try our best to understand Rashi, and then we're going to hit move and then keep going. So 550 is the number of supervisors in 1 Kings. 250 is the number of supervisors in 2 Chronicles chapter 8. Well, what's the real number? Here we go. We keep going. There are therefore altogether four verses contradicting one another. But we may explain it this way, says Rashi. Those that are mentioned in the latter verses, in 1 Kings chapter 9, our verse 23, and 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 10, which I'm holding in my hand, one says 550, one says 250, okay, we're in charge of all of them. Those that are mentioned in the latter verses, in both chapter 9 by us and chapter 8 in 2 Chronicles, we're in charge of everybody. 550 and or 250, those were the super-duper executive board supervisors in charge of everybody. But which was the real number? Was it 250 as per 2 Chronicles, or was it 550? Here we go. It's a fact that Solomon employed these proselytes. Many of these, if not all of them, were gerim, we're told. They were converts to the faith. And he gave them jobs. He employed these proselytes to be the ones who were knocking out the stones and carrying the stones, 80,000 plus 70,000, that 150,000 number, these were converts. And therefore he had full sway over them because they were recently converted to the faith, and he was able to, I hate to say it, subjugate them. They weren't yet, advisors in the palace. And in addition, he had the remaining workers for the store cities, which he also built. Those were native-born Jews. These 300 then, were in charge of the 3,300 men. Which 300? Oh, don't forget. We were told over here in your handout, 3,600 men. Don't forget that. So you can even write it down for your own, just to make it more, quick to see it. In 2 Chronicles chapter 2, we're told 3,600 men. Here in 1 Kings, we're told 3,300 men. So Rashi's got to account for the 300. He does. These 300 native-born Jews were the remaining workers for the store cities. These 300 men, which explain the difference, that number is the difference between 3,300 in Kings and 3,600 in Chronicles. These 300 guys were in charge of the 3,300 men who are mentioned in 1 Kings chapter 5. I'm forgetting it. Chapter 5. Who in turn, and those 3,300 guys were in charge of the 150,000 schleppers, the recent converts to the faith who were doing really all the literal heavy lifting. Okay, so that accounts for the difference between 3,300 in Kings and 3,600 in 2 Chronicles. Those 300 guys were the guys who were in charge of the 3,300, who themselves were in charge of the 150,000. No, where do you get to? I still need an explanation for 250 men, because there was a number coming up of 550.
What's that?
Hold on, I got to at least say it out. Okay. Then you can question all you want. Then I'm just going to say to you, I have no idea what to say. But at least we have to at least lay it all out once and for all, and then take your pot shots as you wish. So let's keep going with the footnote, and then we'll take all the questions. In addition, the 250, which number we need to have, because there's 250 here and 550 there. So Rashi's on the ropes. How do I explain that? So Rashi says that 250 number difference, those 250 guys were in charge of the native-born Jews who were participating in the building of the store cities. And how many were those? 300. So 250 men were supervising 300 native-born Jews who were building the store cities. Now I'm getting it. Rashi justifies injecting the men who participated in the construction of the store cities in the totals of the workers, because these passages, which mention only 250, right? That's 2 Chronicles. Stated there in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, that discusses the store cities. Over here in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 10, it's only discussing store cities. That explains why over here in chapter 8 in 2 Chronicles, there's a discussion of 250 men, because those 250 men were supervising the 300 Jews who were building the store cities. How do you like that? One Jew on top of another Jew saying, you done yet? Have you finished yet? How you doing? Are you okay? I mean, can you imagine one-on-one? That's a chavrusa. That's a yeshiva setting. It's incredible. One-on-one. Hey, how you doing today? Bill, have you done all right? Good.
Yeah.
Are your quotas okay? Good. Miserably okay? Good. I mean, what? I'm on W. You're that the summer sugar. But that's the thing that's what's going on over here. It's like a one-on-one supervisory thing. That's amazing if that's what's going on. And that's the attempt to make some sense out of it. And so, to sum it up, in the book of Kings, he counted the proselyte officers in two separate totals. First, he counted the 3,300 men. The officers who were in charge of 45 men each separately. So we have 3,300 men. Okay, that number is coming up over here in 1 Kings chapter 5. We're told 3,300 men. Those were supervisors in charge of the 45 men each. And then over here in chapter 9, verse 23, where we're told 550 men were in charge, he combined the 300 superior officers who were in charge of the 3,300 with the 250 men who were told to us in 2 Chronicles chapter 8. They were in charge of the building of the star cities, and together you get 550 officers. That explains 550, number 550 of supervisors in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 23. And on the other hand, in 2 Chronicles, he counted all the proselyte officers, the major and the minor ones, together, and there you get 3,600. And they were all proselytes. And the officers in charge of the workers in the store cities, who were Jews, totaling 250 men, he counted, the author of 2 Chronicles, counted those guys separately. What I really needed to do was take out 3 hours of my time and just kind of, and I still can, and just map out who the supervisors, who they're in charge of, what's going on, and lay it out by the verse, by the book, and do it like that, so you'll see the numbers as they play out. 300 plus 250 equals 550, so the 300 unaccounted for in Kings earlier, they come up in Kings later, 550. Oh, good. I don't even know what to say anymore, but this is what the effort is, to try to make some sense out of these four conflicting verses, 3,300 versus 3,600, 250 versus 550. Rashi takes the 300-man difference in the 3,300 to 3,600, brings them in, and adds them to 250, and lo and behold, you get 550. Now I think I can open my eyes again. Now I can open my eyes and I can look you in the face and say, I got nothing more than that. But I'm trying. Any questions, Roberto? Because you know you're going to kill everything I just said. And here we go. Let's go.
I don't have any real answers. I think the problem, to be simplified, we're dealing clearly with two different stages of building. Now, we have the earlier building, which I think may include both the Beis HaMikdash, as well as Pharaoh's, as the Solos Palace. And now we have the, much later after the, those things were described, we have the storehouse cities, right, the temples were dedicated, you know? So once we have that, we don't have one a jumble of four different numbers. We have two different events, and each of them still has a contradiction, but the contradictions are much less. We have two sets, which they're a few hundred apart, but they're not that far apart, you know? So that simplifies it somewhat.
Does Rashi like your approach?
I'm not sure.
I think you are. I think you know what the answer to my question is.
No, wait a minute. So give me a second. No,
Rashi's working hard. He's like in a gym, heavy lifting. Right. He's heavy lifting over here.
You're right. He puts them all together. Which, but I can be... You know, I like my approach.
The discrepancy is the thing. The point is, the discrepancy is the thing. We have it.
No doubt, but if I go the other way, the discrepancy is thousands, right? Because you have four figures that you're all juggling together.
If you break it apart, so the discrepancy in the first section was 300, and the discrepancy in the second
section. That's correct.
And then you play with that, and you get, and there you go.
Okay.
That's all we can do. Best we can do. Thank God that footnote back there in chapter 5 was, I hope, edifying and clarifying. And now we really can potentially proceed on and finish off chapter 9 without even davening it up. We're going to just read and go through. Here we go. That was basically the heaviest of all of it. Here we go. Back to chapter 9, verse 24. Ach basparo alta, or also, however you want to read that word, in Israel, alta, in the kolel also, meir David el besa, asher bana lo, oz bana es hamila. But Paro's daughter, she came up from the city of David to her house, which Shlomo had built for her. And then he built the Milo. We saw earlier, Shlomo has married Pharaoh's daughter. And we said earlier that this was being done in order to do geopolitics and make peace. There's nothing better than having a father-in-law who's the king of Egypt, a couple of miles away. The king of Egypt's not going to do anything at all to jeopardize his daughter's life and his son-in-law's life and all the subjects. Everything's cool. No fighting. No fighting with my son-in-law and my daughter. Now, we got people building stuff, and let's take a look and see what's going on over here. We have skipped over the footnote over here, the recent footnote on verse 23, because I think we basically have accounted for all of it. But Paro's daughter, what's that all about? Okay, but Paro's daughter, says Rashi, who was originally in the Ir David, in the city of David. And if I recall, you still see Ir David in Yerushalayim. It's a rather depressed old Arab neighborhood, kind of at the foot of the Kotel area. That's where Ir David is. But that's where Jewish people were living 3,000 years ago. Okay, Paro's daughter was originally living in the city of David when they got married, as it's stated in the beginning of this book, in our book of 1 Kings, chapter 3. He, Solomon, brought her, the Pharaoh's daughter, to the city of David. So that's where they were living as husband and wife until they built a nice palace for the man. She came up from the city of David. Now in 2 Chronicles chapter 8, Scripture explains, what does it say in 2? No, thank God I got 2 Chronicles over here. Scripture says, Shlomo said, a woman shall not live with me in the city of David. But because we've got the exact wording, let's go ahead and read it. Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh. You know, these two narratives are so identical. It's difficult to argue that they're different narratives and we should have different computations. They're so identical. The number is 70,000 and 80,000. And now Pharaoh's daughter. And the whole thing is just like, it's the same story. It's difficult to argue that they're two different narratives. Verse 11, in 2 Chronicles, let me read this. Solomon brought up the daughter of Pharaoh out of the city of David unto the house that he had built for her. Because he said, quote, Solomon's words, watch, no wife of mine shall dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy, whereunto the ark of God has come. He's saying, it's holy. I can't have my wife staying over there, no wife of mine, lo teshev isha li beveis David melech Yisrael. No wife of mine is going to dwell in the house of David, king of Israel, because the places are holy where the ark of God has come. Ki kodesh hamar shebo alein aron Hashem. So she's got to leave the city of David, and she's got to come up. She's got to, she's obligated to go up into his palace. She can no longer live in the city of David where she was. Why? Because that's too holy. Take a look. For they are holy, for the ark of God was brought to them, says Rashi. The whole city, all the houses. And here's the footnote. This refers to the section known as Sion, where the Aron Kodesh, where the ark had been kept prior to the building of the temple. See 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 12. And see above, here in our own book of Kings, chapter 8, verse 1. Shlomo considered it sacrilegious. Listen to this. Shlomo considered it sacrilegious to cohabit with a woman in a place that had been the home of the Aron Kodesh, the Holy Ark. He therefore forced her to leave the Eir David and to come into his palace, because in the Eir David, that's where the Holy Ark had been. And it's just not right for you and me to be there anymore. You got to come up, honey, to our new palace, and we cannot be together as husband and wife where the ark had been for some time. That's holy place now, and that's it. Holy place is holy place. We are not going to be husband and wife over there. You got to come on up to my new palace. Here you go. And what's this Milo? We said earlier it was a place where Shlomo extended, according to Rashi, extended like the city limits to enable pilgrims, those who were Olerega, those who had come up to the temple in Jerusalem. He wanted to enable them to eat their sacrificial meat in Yerushalayim. And there are a lot of people. So he's going to extend the area. And he did that. And the place is called Milo. And I'll finish this off over here. We'll finish up verse 24, because we're coming on to 8:30. The Milo, says Rashi, to build within it houses for her manservants and maidservants. That's what he was building in this place called Milo. Houses for the servants. What do you got?
Okay, so if this house is for the servants, how is it for the pilgrims? And in verse 15, he says that it was in Yerushalayim in the city of David.
Uh-huh.
So why would the servants be in Eir David rather than where she is?
Good question. Let me just see verse 15. Where see about verse 15, the Milo.
7C.
The Milo. The servant quarters were built next to Milo, not in the city of David.
But Rashi said on verse 15 that Milo was in the city of David.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the Milo, says Rashi, a place that was in Jerusalem in the city of David. That was called Milo. It was enclosed by a low wall and was filled with dirt. It's derived from the word malay, full. Others explain that the Milo was a plaza where the people would gather on joyous occasions. King David had built up the city as far as Milo, but he didn't build up Milo itself. Shlomo did that. And the Sofim combines both. He extended it, built up the area to provide quarters for the pilgrims. So, Mrs. Burlov, your question is, according to Rashi, Milo is a neighborhood in the city of David, and therefore, what's the problem?
Why is he building houses for her manservants and maidservants there?
If she can't live there, but they can live there, so I think it's okay. They're going to have to just commute. They're going to have to travel a little bit. Then maybe they're not going to be, you know, living in the palace. I remember when I was a kid in the Sterner Choir, they put the choir into a very, very a dungeon-like building called, I forgot what, and we had to walk a little bit up the hill to the main building where they put all the real people. But the choir, they put into the Blackstone. That's the name of it, the Blackstone. So this was like the Blackstone for the... And it's in the holy city. Okay, and we're going to finish up this.
There's a Malbim here.
Okay, I don't know if we're going to get the Malbim today.
Yeah, I'll get to the end of it, Eddie.
Okay.
Answers. He calls man to Yosefson Basparo, as long as Basparo would have been in Beis David, lo hoyo inyan habayis nishlam. The whole spiritual completion of Beis Hamikdash was not effective yet. It's fully, you know, in place. Why? Here's the key words. Ki yashva isha bas nechar. Shem, that Batsheba, notwithstanding that we assume that she was converted, she was still a foreign woman, as opposed to the servants, I suppose, that would have really installed there, were not foreign. We don't see that those servants were gay women, I don't think, do we? So let's assume the servants are native-born Jews.
Right.
She was not, and this was a little bit of a, according to the Malbim's take, a pagam, a blemish on the spirituality. I think that's what the Malbim is trying
and
to
that
say.
Forces her out of the Ir David,
right,
which is holy, because the ark was in the city of David, and it's not appropriate for a foreign woman to be there.
Probably, because it's Kiryat Yamin. Pasuk seems to contradict that. It says any woman doesn't mention foreign.
Any woman of mine.
Yeah.
Right. True. We're going to just finish up this Rashi, and we're going to call it a night. We'll finish up Gavali next week with the chapter. Concerning this place of Milo, where he built houses for his maidservants and the manservants of his wife, concerning that, Yeroboam admonished him, saying, your father left it open for the pilgrims, and yet you enclosed it to make a labor force for Pharaoh's daughter. This is the inference of the word but mentioned here. Ach, bas paro, also meir David. But Paro's daughter came up from the city of David. Why the word but? Because Shlomo is getting some musr, some admonishment from Yeroboam, saying, what are you doing? Your father David left it over for pilgrims. For their sake, they need a place. You're enclosing it? You're making quarters? What? You're making like a little a hostel for the maidservants and manservants of your foreign wife? What are you doing? But in this did Shlomo sin. But in this did Shlomo sin. So have I heard. I say, so says Rashi. Rashi says, so have I heard. I say, however, but the words, but Paro's daughter, that is to say, what does it mean, but Paro's daughter? The above-mentioned cities were necessary to build for store cities, for chariots, for riders, for greatness, that is, for important purposes. That's why he built things in Milo, for all those reasons, store cities and chariots and riders. But the Milo he did not build for any greatness. His father had left it for the pilgrims to pitch their tents there. But since Paro's daughter had gone up to her house, and the Milo was adjacent to that house, then he built up the Milo.
So now he's saying it's adjacent to her house, so is it in Ir David or is it adjacent to her house?
I don't know. Sorry. Can't explain every Rashi, even if I try. All I can tell you is this is what Rashi says, and none of us were there, but we try our best to figure it all out.
Including
and that's
Rashi.
The Milo, including Rashi, right? So this is what's going on. So we finished, thank God, verse 24, and I think that with God's help, we'll finish chapter 9 next week. Hopefully everybody can come back. It's only a few psukim. And then we're going to, God willing, we're going to see Queen of Sheba. Malkat Sheba, we're going to be introduced to the chapter of the Queen of Sheba. And maybe I'll show you how children are taught the chapter of the Queen of Sheba, how little children are shown the pictorials and all the midrashim and the whole thing. Should be very interesting. Please come on back next week. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Zeigazin, have a great week. Thanks for calling in. Take care and be well. Bye.